Side 7.
"Excuse me, Mr. Dibbler," said the poster artist, who had been hovering uneasily. "I don't understand this bit here."
Dibbler snatched the paper from him.
"Which bit?" he snapped.
"Where you're describing Mr. Sin."
"It's obvious," said Dibbler.
"What we want here is to conjure up the exotic, alluring, yet distant romance of pyramid-studded Klatch, right? So naturally, we gotta use the symbol of a mysterious and unscrutable continent, see? Do I have to explain everything to everyone all the time?"
"It's just that I thought..."
the artist began.
"Just do it!"
The artist looked down at the paper.
"She has the face," he read, "of a spink."
"Right," said Dibbler, "right!
I thought maybe Sphinx."
"Will you listen to the man?"
said Dibbler, talking to the sky again. He glared at the artist.
"She doesn't look like two of them, does she? One spink, two spinks, then just get on with it. I want those posters all round the city first thing tomorrow."
The artist gave Victor an agonized look he was coming to recognize. Everyone around Dibbler wore them after a while.
"Right you are, Mr. Dibbler," he said.
"Right."
Dibbler turned to Victor.
"Why aren't you changed?" he said.
Victor ducked quickly into a tent. A little old lady, shaped like a cottage loaf, helped him into a costume apparently made of sheets inexpertly dyed black. Although given the current state of accommodation in Holywood, they were probably just sheets taken off a bed at random. Mrs. Marietta Cosmopolite, former Ankh-Morpork seamstress, until her dreams led her to Holywood, where she found her skill with a needle was highly prized. Once a darner of casual socks, now a knitter of fake chainmail for trolls, and able to run up a pair of harem trousers in a trice. Then she handed him a curved sword.
"Why is it bent?" he said.
"I think it's meant to be, dear," she said doubtfully.
"I thought swords had to be straight," said Victor.
Outside he could hear Dibbler asking the sky why everyone was so stupid.
"Perhaps they start out straight and go bendy with use," said the old lady, patting him on the hand. "A lot of things do."
She gave him a bright smile.
"If you're all right, dear, I better go and help the young lady in case any little dwarfs is peering in at her."
She waddled out of the tent. From the tent next door came a metallic clinking noise and the sound of Ginger's voice raised in complaint. Victor made a few experimental slashes with the sword. Gaspode watched him with his head on one side.
"What are you supposed to be?" he said at last.
"A leader of a pack of desert bandits, apparently," said Victor. "Romantic and dashing."
"Dashing where?"
"Just dashing generally, I guess." "Gaspode, what did you mean when you said it's got Dibbler?"
The dog gnawed at a paw.
"Look at his eyes," he said. "They're even worse than yours."
"Mine? What's wrong with mine?"
Detritus the troll stuck his head through the tent flaps.
"Mr. Dibbler says he wants you now," he said.
"Eyes?" said Victor. "Something about my eyes?"
"Woof."
"Mr. Dibbler says..."
Detritus began.
All right, I'm coming."
Victor stepped out of his tent at the same time as Ginger stepped out of hers. He shut his eyes.
"Gosh, I'm sorry," he babbled. "I'll go back and wait for you to get dressed."
"I am dressed." "Mr. Dibbler says," said Detritus behind him.
"Come on," said Ginger, grabbing his arm. "We mustn't keep everyone waiting."
"But you're...
Victor looked down, which wasn't a help.
"You've got a navel in your diamond," he hazarded.
"I've come to terms with that," said Ginger, flexing her shoulders in an effort to make everything settle. "It's these two saucepan lids that are giving me problems. Makes you realize what those poor girls in the harems must suffer."
"And you don't mind people seeing you like that?"
said Victor, amazed. "Why should I? This is moving pictures. It's not as if it's real. Anyway, you'd be amazed at what girls have to do for a lot less than $10 a day."
"9,
said Gaspode, who was still trailing at Victor's heels.
"Right. Gather round, people," shouted Dibbler through a megaphone. "Sons of the desert, over there, please. Where are the slave girls? Right. Handlemen."
"I've never seen so many people in a click," Ginger whispered. "It must be costing more than $100. Victor eyed the sons of the desert. It looked as though Dibbler had dropped in at Borgle's and hired the 20 people nearest the door, irrespective of their appropriateness, and had given them each Dibbler's idea of a desert bandit headdress. There were trollish sons of the desert. Rock recognized him and gave him a little wave. Dwarf sons of the desert, and shuffling into the end of the line, a small, hairy, and furiously scratching son in a headdress that reached down to his paws.
"Grab her, become entranced by her beauty, and then throw her over your pommel."
Dibbler's voice intruded into his consciousness. Victor desperately re-ran the half-heard instructions past his mind.
"My what?" he said.
"It's part of your saddle," Ginger hissed.
"Oh."
"And then you ride into the night with all the sons following you and singing rousing desert bandit songs."
"No one'll hear them," said Sol, helpfully, "but if they open and shut their mouths, it'll help create a ambience."
"But it isn't the night," said Ginger. "It's broad daylight."
Dibbler stared at her. His mouth opened once or twice.
"Sol!" he shouted.
"We can't film at night, Uncle," said the nephew hurriedly. "The demons wouldn't be able to see.
I don't see why we can't put up a card saying night time at the start of the scene so that—"
"That's not the magic of moving pictures," snapped Dibbler. "That's just messing about."
"Excuse me," said Victor. "Excuse me, but surely it doesn't matter, because surely the demons can paint the sky black with stars on it."
There was a moment's silence. Then Dibbler looked at Gaffer.
"Can they?" he said.
"Nah," said the handleman. "It's bloody hard enough to make sure they paint what they do see, never mind what they don't."
Dibbler rubbed his nose.
"I might be prepared to negotiate," he said.
The handleman shrugged.
"You don't understand, Mr. Dibbler. What they want money for, they don't really eat it. We start telling them to paint what isn't there, we're into all sorts of—"
"Perhaps it's just a very bright full moon," said Ginger.
"That's good thinking," said Dibbler. "We'll do a card where Victor says to Ginger something like, 'How bright the moon is tonight, Buana.'"
"Well, something like that," said Sol, diplomatically.
It was noon. Holywood Hill glistened under the sun like a champagne-flavoured wine gum that had been half-sucked. The handlemen turned their handles, the extras charged enthusiastically backwards and forwards, Dibbler raged at everyone, and cinematographic history was made with a shot of 3 dwarfs, 4 men, 2 trolls and a dog, all riding 1 camel and screaming in terror for it to stop. Victor was introduced to the camel. It blinked its long eyelashes at him and appeared to chew soap. It was kneeling down, and it looked like a camel that had had a long morning and wasn't about to take any shit from anyone. So far it had kicked 3 people.
"What's it called?" he said cautiously.
"We call it Evil-Minded Son of a Bitch," said the newly appointed vice-president in charge of camels.
"That doesn't sound like a name."
"It's a good name for this camel," said the handler fervently. "There's nothing wrong with being a son of a bitch," said a voice behind him. "I'm a son of a bitch. My father was a son of a bitch, you greasy nightshirt-wearing bastard."
The handler grinned nervously at Victor and turned around. There was no one behind him. He looked down.
"Woof," said Gaspode, and wagged what was almost a tail.
"Did you hear someone say something?" said the handler carefully.
"No,"
said Victor. He leaned close to one of the camel's ears and whispered in case it was a special Holywood camel.
"Look, I'm a friend, okay?"
Evil-minded son of a bitch flicked a carpet-thick ear. Camels are far too intelligent to admit to being intelligent.
"How do you ride it?" he said.
"When you want to go forward, you swear at it and hit it with a stick, and when you want to stop, you swear at it and really hit it with a stick."
"What happens if you want it to turn?"
"Ah, well, you're on to advanced manual there. Best thing to do is get off and do it round by hand."
"When you're ready," Dibbler bellowed through his megaphone. "Now, you ride up to the tent, leap off the camel, fight the huge eunuchs, burst into the tent, drag the girl out, get back on the camel and away. Got it? Think you can do that?"
"What huge eunuchs?" said Victor, as the camel unfolded itself upwards.
One of the huge eunuchs shyly raised his hand.
"It's me, Maury," it said.
"Oh, hi, Maury."
"Hi, Vic."
"And me, Rock,"
said a second huge eunuch.
"Hi, Rock,"
Hey, Vic. Places, everyone, said Dibbler. What is it, Rock?
I was just wondering, Mr. Dibbler, what is my motivation for this scene?
Motivation?
Yes, I got to know, see, said Rock.
How about I'll fire you if you don't do it properly?
Rock grinned.
Right you are, Mr. Dibbler, he said.
Okay, said Dibbler. Everyone ready? Turn 'em.
Evil-minded son of a bitch turned awkwardly, legs flailing at odd camel angles, and then lumbered into a complicated trot. The handle turned, the air glittered, and Victor awoke. It was like rising slowly out of a pink cloud, or a magnificent dream which, try as you might, drains out of your mind as the daylight shuffles in, leaving a terrible sense of loss. Nothing, you know instinctively, nothing you're going to experience for the rest of the day is going to be one half as good as that dream. He blinked. The images faded away. He was aware of an ache in his muscles, as if he'd recently been really exerting himself.
What happened? He mumbled.
He looked down.
Wow, he said.
An expanse of barely clad buttock occupied a view recently occupied by the camel's neck. It was an improvement.
Why, said Ginger, icily, am I lying on a camel?
Search me, didn't you want to?
She slid down onto the sand and tried to adjust her costume. At this point, they both became aware of the audience. There was Dibbler, there was Dibbler's nephew, there was the handleman, there were the extras, there were the assorted vice presidents and other people who were apparently called into existence by the mere presence of moving picture creation. Some of them have clipboards. There was Gaspo the Wonder Dog, and everyone, except for the dog, who was sniggering, had his mouth open. The handleman's hand was still turning the handle. He looked down as if its presence was new to him and stopped. Dibbler seemed to come out of whatever trance he was in.
Whoa, ho, 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 he said. Blimey. Magic, breathed Sol. Real magic.
Dibbler nudged the handleman.
Did you get all that? He said.
Get what?
Said Ginger and Victor together. Then Victor noticed Morrie sitting on the sand. There was a sizable chip out of his arm. Rock was troweling something into it. The troll noticed Victor's expression and gave him a sickly grin.
Think you're Conan the Barbarian, do you?
He said.
Yeah, said Rock. There was no call to go calling him what you called him. And if you're going to do fancy sword work, we're replying for an extra dollar a day, having bits chopped off allowance.
Victor's sword had several nicks on the blade. For the life of him, he couldn't imagine how they'd got there.
Look, he said desperately, I don't understand. I didn't call anyone anything. Have we started filming yet?
1 minute I'm sitting in a tent. Next minute I'm breathing camel, said Ginger petulantly. Is it too much to ask what is going on?
But no one seemed to be listening to them.
Why can't we find a way of getting sound? Said Dibbler. That was damn good dialogue there. Didn't understand a word of it, but I know good dialogue when I hear it.
Parrots, said the handleman flatly. Your common Hawandaland green. Amazing bird, memory like elephant. Get a couple of dozen in different sizes, and you got a full vocal.
That launched a detailed technical discussion. Victor let himself slide off the camel's back and ducked under its neck to reach Ginger.
Listen, he said urgently. It was just like last time, only stronger, like a sort of dream. The handleman started to take pictures and it was just like a dream.
Yeah, but what did we actually do? She said.
What you did, said Rock, was gallop the camel up to the tent, leap off, come at us like a windmill. Leaping on rocks and laughing, said Morrie. Yeah, you said to Morrie, have at you, you foul black guard, said Rock, and then you caught him a right ding on the arm, cut a hole in the tent.
Good sword work, though, said Morrie appraisingly. A bit showy, but pretty good.
But I don't know how to, Victor began. And she was lying there all long grass, said Rock, and you swept her up, and she said...
Long grass, said Ginger, weakly.
Languorous, said Victor. I think he means languorous.
She said, why, it is the thief of...
Rock hesitated.
Dad's bag, I think he said.
Bag's dad, said Murray, rubbing his arm.
Yeah. And then she said, "You are in great danger, for my father has sworn to kill you." And Victor said, "But now, O fairest Rose, I can reveal that I am really the shadow of the desert."
"What's Langerous mean?" said Ginger suspiciously.
And then he said, "Fly with me now to the Casbah," or something like that. And then he gave her this thing humans do with their lips.
"Whistle?" said Victor, with a hopeless hope.
"Nah, the other thing. Sounds like a cork coming out of a bottle," said Rock.
"Kiss," said Ginger coldly.
"Yeah, not that I'm in a judge," said Rock, "but it seemed to go on for a while. Definitely very, you know, kissy."
"I thought it was going to be bucky to water time meself," said a quiet canine voice behind Victor.
He kicked out backwards, but failed to connect.
"And then he was back on the camel and dragged her up, and Mr. Dibbler shouted, 'Stop, stop, what the hell's going on? Why won't anybody tell me what's going on?'" said Rock. "And then you said, 'What happened?'"
"Don't know when a last source sword play like that," said Murray.
"Oh," said Victor. "Well, thank you."
"All that shouting, ha, and have a you dog."
"Very professional," said Murray.
"I see," said Victor. He reached sideways and grabbed Ginger's arm.
"We've got to talk," he hissed, "somewhere quiet, behind the tent."
"If you think I'm going anywhere alone with you," she began.
"Listen, this is no time to start acting like—"
A heavy hand settled on Victor's shoulder. He turned and saw the shape of Detritus eclipsing the world.
"Mr. Dibbler doesn't want anyone running off," he said. "Everyone has to stay until Mr. Dibbler says."
"You're a real pain, you know," said Victor.
Detritus gave him a big gem-studded grin. Troll's teeth are made of diamond.
"Mr. Dibbler says I can be a vice president," he said proudly.
"In charge of what?" said Victor.
"Vice presidents," said Detritus.
Gaspode the Wonder Dog made a little growling sound at the back of his throat. The camel, which had been idly staring at the sky, sidled around a bit and suddenly lashed out with a kick that caught the troll in the small of the back. Detritus yelped. Gaspode gave the world a look of satisfied innocence.
"Come on," said Victor, grimly, "while he's trying to find something to hit the camel with."
They sat down in the shade behind the tent.
"I just want you to know," said Ginger coldly, "that I have never attempted to look languorous in my life."
"Could be worth a try," said Victor, absently.
"What?"
"Sorry, look, something made us act like that. I don't know how to use a sword. I've always just waved it around. What did you feel like?"
"You know how you feel when you hear someone say something and you realize you've been daydreaming?"
"It was like your own life fading away and something else filling up the space."
They considered this in silence.
"Do you think it's something to do with holy wood?" she said.
Victor nodded. Then he threw himself sideways and landed on Gaspode, who'd been watching them intently.
"Yelp," said Gaspode.
"Now listen," Victor hissed into his ear. "No more of these hints. What is it that you noticed about us? Otherwise it's detritus for you, with mustard."
The dog squirmed in his grip.
"Or we could make you wear a muzzle," said Ginger. "I ain't dangerous," wailed Gaspode, scrabbling with his paws in the sand.
"A talking dog sounds pretty dangerous to me," said Victor.
"Dreadfully," said Ginger. "You never know what it might say."
"See, see," said Gaspode, mournfully.
"I knew it'd be nothing but trouble showing I can talk. It shouldn't happen to a dog."
"But it's going to," said Victor.
"Oh, all right, for what good it'll do," muttered Gaspode.
Victor relaxed. The dog sat up and shook sand off himself.
"You won't understand it anyway," he grumbled.
"Another dog would understand, but you won't. It's down to species experience, see? Like kissing. You know what it's like, but I don't. It's not a canine experience."
He noticed the warning look in Victor's eyes and plunged on.
"The way you look as if you belong here."
He watched them for a moment.
"See? See?" he said. "I told you you wouldn't understand. It's
It's territory, see? You got all the signs of being right where you should be. Nearly everyone else here is a stranger, but you aren't. Like you must have noticed where some dogs bark at you when you're new to a place. It's not just smell. We got this amazing sense of displacement. Like, some humans get uncomfortable when they see a picture on crooked. It's like that, only worse. It's kind of like the only place you ought to be now is here.
He looked at them again and then industriously scratched an ear. What the hell? He said. The trouble is, I can explain it in dog, but you only listen in human.
It sounds a bit mystical to me, said Ginger.
You said something about my eyes, said Victor.
Yeah, well, have you looked at your own eyes? Gaspard nodded at Ginger. You too, miss.
Don't be daft, said Victor. How can we look at our own eyes?
Gaspard shrugged. You could look at each other's, he suggested. They automatically turned to face each other. There was a long, drawn-out moment. Gaspard employed it to urinate noisily against a tent peg. Eventually Victor said,
Wow.
Ginger said,
Mine too.
Yes, doesn't it hurt? You should know.
There you are, then, said Gaspard. And you look at Dibbler next time you see him. Really look, I mean.
Victor rubbed his eyes, which were beginning to water.
It's as though Holy Wood has called us here, is doing something to us, and has...
Branded us, said Ginger bitterly. That's what it's done.
It does look quite attractive, actually, said Victor gallantly. Gives them a sort of sparkle.
A shadow fell across the sand.
Ah, there you are, said Dibbler.
He put his arms around their shoulders as they stood up and gave them a sort of hug.
You young people always going off alone together, he said archly. Great business, great business. Very romantic, but we've got a click to make, and I've got lots of people standing around waiting for you, so let's do it.
See what I mean, muttered Gaspard very quietly.
When you knew what you were looking for, you couldn't miss it. In the centre of both of Dibbler's eyes was a tiny golden star. In the heartlands of the great dark continent of Klatch, the air was heavy and pregnant with the promise of the coming monsoon. Bullfrogs croaked in the rushes, but were edited out of the finished production, by the slow brown river. Crocodiles dozed on the mudflats. Nature was holding its breath. A cooing broke out in the pigeon loft of Azhur al-Nkoit, stock dealer. He stopped dozing on the veranda and went to see what had caused the excitement. In the vast pens behind the shack, a few threadbare wildebeests, marked down for a quick sale, yawning and cudding in the heat, looked up in alarm as Nkoit leapt the veranda steps in one bound and tore towards them. He rounded the zebra pens and homed in on his assistant Mbu, who was peacefully mucking out the ostriches.
How many?
He stopped and began to wheeze. Mbu, who was 12 years old, dropped his shovel and patted him heavily on the back.
How many?
He tried again.
You've been overdoing it again, boss, said Mbu in a concerned voice.
How many elephants we got?
I just done them, said Mbu. We got 3.
Are you sure?
Yes, boss, said Mbu evenly. It's easy to be sure with elephants.
Azural crouched in the red dust and hurriedly began to scrawl figures with a stick.
"Old Mulukai's bound to have 6, he muttered, "and Pazikal's usually got 20 or so, and then the people on the delta generally have—"
"Someone want elephants, boss?"
"Got 15 head, he was telling me, plus also there's a load at the logging camp probably going cheap. Call it 2 dozen."
"Someone want a lot of elephants, boss?"
"Was saying there's a herd over Tetse way. Shouldn't be a problem, but then there's all the valleys over towards—"
Mbu leaned on the fence and waited.
"Maybe 200, give or take 10,
said Azural, throwing down the stick.
"Ugh, nowhere near enough."
"You can't give or take 10 elephants, boss, said Mbu firmly.
He knew that counting elephants was a precision job.
A man might be uncertain about how many wives he had, but never about elephants. Either you had one or you didn't.
Our agent in Clatch has an order for...
Azarel swallowed.
1,000 elephants. 1,000. Immediately. Cash on delivery.
Azarel let the paper drop to the ground.
To a place called Ankh-Morpork, he said despondently.
He sighed.
It would have been nice, he said.
M'Boo scratched his head and stared at the hammerhead clouds massing over Mount Fatwangi. Soon the dry veldt would boom to the thunder of the rains. Then he reached down and picked up the stick.
What are you doing? Said Azurel.
Drawing a map, boss, said M'Boo.
Azurel shook his head.
Not worth it, boy. 3,000 miles to Ankh, I reckon. I let myself get carried away. Too many miles. Not enough elephants.
We could go across the plains, boss, said M'Boo. Lot of elephants on the plains. Send messengers ahead. We could pick up plenty more elephants on the way, no problem. That whole plain just about covered in damn elephants.
No, we'd have to go around on the coast, said the dealer, drawing a long curving line in the sand. The reason being there's the jungle just here.
He tapped on the parched ground. And here, he tapped again, slightly concussing an emerging locust that had optimistically mistaken the first tap for an onset of the rains.
No roads in the jungle.
M'Boo took the stick and drew a line straight through the jungle.
Where 1,000 elephants want to go, boss, they don't need no roads.
Azarel considered this. Then he took the stick and drew a jagged line by the jungle.
But here's the mountains of the sun, he said, very high, lots of deep ravines, and no bridges.
M'Boo took the stick, indicated the jungle, and grinned.
I know where there's a lot of prime timber just been uprooted, boss, he said. Yeah? Okay, boy, but we've still got to get it into the mountains. It just so happened that 1,000 real strong elephants'll be going that way, boss.
M'Boo grinned again. His tribe went in for sharpening their teeth to points. Not for any particular religious reason, they just rather liked the effect when they grinned. He handed back the stick. Azurel's mouth opened slowly.
By the 7 moons of Nazrim, he breathed. We could do it, you know. It's only, 1,300 or 1,400 miles that way. Maybe less even. Yeah, we could really do it.
Yes, boss.
You know, I've always wanted to do something big with my life, something real, said Azurel. I mean, an ostrich here, a giraffe there, it's not the sort of thing you get remembered for.
He stared at the purple-grey horizon.
We could do it, couldn't we? He said.
Sure, boss.
Right over the mountains.
Sure, boss.
If you looked really hard, you could just see that the purple-grey was topped with white.
They're pretty high mountains, said Azurel, his voice now edged with doubt. Slope go up, slope go down, said M'Boo, gnomically. That's true, said Azurel. Like, on average, it's flat all the way.
He gazed at the mountains again.
1,000 elephants, he muttered. Do you know, boy, when they built the tomb of King Leonid of Ephib, they used 100 elephants to cart the stone, and 200 elephants, history tells us, were employed in the building of the palace of the Hroxi in Clatch City.
Thunder rumbled in the distance.
1,000 elephants, Azarel repeated. 1,000 elephants. I wonder what they want them for.
The rest of the day passed in a trance for Victor. There was more galloping and fighting, and more rearranging of time. Victor still found that hard to understand. Apparently, the film could be cut up and then stuck together again later, so that things happened in the right order. And some things didn't have to happen at all. He saw the artist draw one card, which said, In the King's Palace, 1 hour later. 1 hour of time had been vanished, just like that. Of course, he knew that it hadn't really been surgically removed from his life. It was the sort of thing that happened all the time in books. And on the stage, too.
He'd seen a group of strolling players once, and the performance had leapt magically from a battlefield into thought to the Ephebian fortress that night, with no more than a brief descent of the sackcloth curtain and a lot of muffled bumping and cursing as the scenery was changed. But this was different. 10 minutes after doing a scene, you'd do another scene that was taking place the day before, somewhere else, because Dibbler had rented the tents for both scenes and didn't want to have to pay any more rent than necessary. You just had to try and forget about everything, but now, and that was hard when you were also waiting every moment for that fading sensation. It didn't come. Just after another half-hearted fight scene, Dibbler announced that it was all finished.
"Aren't we going to do the ending?" said Ginger.
"You did that this morning," said Sol.
"Oh."
There was a chittering noise as the demons were let out of their box and sat swinging their little legs on the edge of the lid and passing a tiny cigarette from hand to hand. The extras queued up for their wages. The camel kicked the vice president in charge of camels. The handle men wound the great reels of film out of the boxes and went away to whatever arcane cutting and gluing the handle men got up to in the hours of darkness. Miss Cosmopolite, vice president in charge of wardrobe, gathered up the costumes and toddled off, possibly to put them back on the beds. A few acres of scrubby backlot stopped being the rolling dunes of the great Neff, and went back to being scrubby backlot again. Victor felt that much the same thing was happening to him. In ones and twos, the makers of moving picture magic departed, laughing and joking, and arranging to meet at Borgel's later on. Ginger and Victor were left alone in a widening circle of emptiness.
"I felt like this the first time the circus went away," said Ginger.
"Mr. Dibbler said we were going to do another one tomorrow," said Victor. "I'm sure he just makes them up as he goes along. Still, we got $10 each. Minus what we owe Gaspode," he added conscientiously.
He grinned foolishly at her.
"Cheer up," he said. "You're doing what you've always wanted to do."
"Don't be stupid. I didn't even know about moving pictures a couple of months ago. There weren't any."
They strolled aimlessly towards the town.
"What did you want to be?" he ventured.
She shrugged.
"I didn't know. I just knew I didn't want to be a milkmaid."
There had been milkmaids at home. Victor tried to recollect anything about them.
"It always looked quite an interesting job to me, milkmaiding," he said vaguely. "Buttercups, you know, and fresh air."
"It's cold and wet, and just as you finish, the bloody cow kicks the bucket over. Don't tell me about milking. Or being a shepherdess, or a goose girl. I really hated our farm."
"Oh."
"And they expected me to marry my cousin when I was 15.
"Is that allowed?"
"Oh, yes, everyone marries their cousins where I come from."
"Why?" said Victor.
"I suppose it saves having to worry about what to do on Saturday nights."
"Oh."
"Didn't you want to be anything?"
said Ginger, putting a whole sentence worth of disdain in a mere 3 letters.
"Not really," said Victor. "Everything looks interesting until you do it. Then you find it's just another job. I bet even people like Cohen the Barbarian get up in the morning thinking, 'Oh, no, not another day of crushing the jeweled thrones of the world beneath my sandaled feet.'"
"Is that what he does?"
said Ginger, interested despite herself.
"According to the stories, yes."
"Why?"
"Search me. It's just a job, I guess."
Ginger picked up a handful of sand. There were tiny white shells in it, which stayed behind as it trickled away between her fingers.
"I remember when the circus came to our village," she said. "I was 10. There was this girl with spangled tights. She walked a tightrope. She could even do somersaults on it. Everybody cheered and clapped. They wouldn't let me climb a tree, but they cheered her. That's when I decided."
"Ah," said Victor, trying to keep up with the psychology of this. "You decided you wanted to be someone."
"Don't be silly. That's when I decided I was going to be a lot more than just someone."
She threw the shells towards the sunset and laughed.
"I'm going to be the most famous person in the world. Everyone will fall in love with me, and I shall live forever."
"Well, it's always best to know your own mind," said Victor, diplomatically.
"You know what the greatest tragedy is in the whole world?"
said Ginger, not paying him the least attention.
"It's all the people who never find out what it is they really want to do, or what it is they're really good at. It's all the sons who become blacksmiths because their fathers were blacksmiths.
It's all the people who could be really fantastic flute players, who grow old and die without ever seeing a musical instrument, so they become bad plowmen instead. It's all the people with talents who never even find out. Maybe they're never even born in a time when it's even possible to find out. She took a deep breath. It's all the people who never get to know what it is they can really be. It's all the wasted chances. Well, Holywood is my chance. Do you understand? This is my time for getting. Victor didn't.
Yes, he said.
Magic for ordinary people, Silverfish had called it. A man turned a handle and your life got changed.
And not just for me, Ginger went on. It's a chance for all of us. The people who aren't wizards and kings and heroes. Hollywood's like a big bubbling stew, but this time different ingredients float to the top. Suddenly there's all these new things for people to do. Do you know the theaters don't even allow women to act? But Hollywood does. And in Hollywood there's jobs for trolls that don't just involve hitting people. And what did the handlemen do before they had handles to turn?
She waved a hand vaguely in the direction of Ankh Morpork's distant glow. Now they're trying to find ways of adding sound to moving pictures, she said, and out there are people who'll turn out to be amazingly good at making soundies. They don't even know it yet, but they're out there, I can feel them, they're out there.
Her eyes were glowing gold. It might just be the sunset, Victor thought, but...
Because of Hollywood, hundreds of people are finding out what it is they really want to be, said Ginger, and thousands are getting a chance to forget themselves for an hour or so. This whole damn world is being given a shake.
That's it, said Victor. That's what worries me. It's as though we're being slotted in. You think we're using Hollywood, but Hollywood is using us, all of us.
How? Why?
I don't know, but
look at wizards. Ginger went on, vibrating with indignation. What good has their magic ever done anyone?
I think it sort of holds the world together, Victor began.
They're pretty good at magic flames and things, but can they make a loaf of bread?
Ginger wasn't in the mood for listening to anyone.
Not for very long, said Victor helplessly.
What does that mean?
Something real, like a loaf of bread, contains a lot of... Well, I suppose you'd call it energy, said Victor. It takes a massive amount of power to create that amount of energy. You'd have to be a pretty good wizard to make a loaf that'd last in this world for more than a tiny part of a second. But that's not what magic is really about, you see, he added quickly, because this world is...
Who cares, said Ginger. Hollywood's really doing things for ordinary people. Silver screen magic.
What's come over you?
Last night. That was then, said Ginger impatiently. Don't you see we could be going somewhere? We could be becoming someone. Because of Hollywood, the world is our
lobster, said Victor.
She waved a hand irritably.
Any shellfish you like, she said. I was thinking of oysters, actually.
Were you? I was thinking of lobsters.
End of side 7.